Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science, with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill discuss how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. The veteran biotech executive also shares his thoughts on how to keep things innovative at a company that's been around since the 1860s. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can find this episode and many more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
At Popular Science, we report and write dozens of science and tech stories every week. And while most of the stuff we stumble across makes it into our articles, we also find plenty of weird facts that we just keep around the office. So we figured, why not share those with you? Welcome to The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week from the editors of Popular Science. I'm Rachel Feltman.
I'm Claire Maldarelli.
I'm Pravita Saha.
Pravita, welcome to the show.
Yay!
Listeners, Pravita is one of the newest members of Team PopSci. She was previously at Audubon and is now a fantastic senior editor for us. And hopefully we'll be on some future episodes of Weirdest Thing, sharing some weird things. Thank you for coming on.
I'm so excited.
Awesome. I just actually sent Pravita a link to something about dead birds today. maybe future episode fodder. But yeah, this is how the weirdest thing magic happens. We just Slack each other weird things, and they take us off on flights of fancy. Oh, bird pun. Oh, no. Okay, so on The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week, we start by each offering up a little tease about some kind of fact or story that we heard in the course of reading, writing, reporting, etc., and decide which one we just absolutely have to hear more about first. Then, once we've all had time to spin our little science yarns, we reconvene and decide what the weirdest thing we learned this week actually was. Claire, what's your tease?
Yes, I would like to talk about the most dedicated knucklecracker of all time.
Not me.
Not me either. Spoiler.
Okay, my fact is about an investigation into something called muslin disease, which was supposedly deadly fashion trend.
Another disease.
I know. Okay, Claire, I mean, I don't want to speak for you because I know your hypochondria can really have a life of its own, but I don't think this is one that's going to convince you that you have something.
You would be surprised, but I take on that challenge.
Okay, fingers crossed. But yeah, investigating this so-called muslin disease then just led me on a whole journey about the time when the hottest thing you could do as a woman was die.
So, gosh.
Maybe still true today, depending on who you ask. Rubito, what's your tease?
I'll talk about how one of my favorite comedians taught me more about a secret part of the female reproductive anatomy.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yes.
What do we want to start with? Claire, why don't you tell us about some knuckle cracking?
Okay, sounds good. I really want to get this off my chest. Okay, so everyone's been told by their moms, don't crack your knuckles. I don't know. I've been told that. Has everyone been told that?
I don't know
that?
If my mom has told me that, but it's something I heard for
okay.
sure.
Okay, well, it's
probably
like
teachers who were mad at me that I was cracking knuckles.
But it's definitely like a mom thing.
Sure.
I don't know. Okay. Well, growing up in my house, my older sister was like the resident knuckle cracker, and she was capable of popping every single joint and every single phalange in both of her hands. And it drove my mom insane, and she tried to scare my sister into stopping by telling her all these terrible things that would happen, mainly that she would get arthritis. Mm-hmm. Now, my mom also told us, or my grandma told us, then passed it on to my mom, that if you drink coffee, it will stunt your growth. So there are a lot of like weird things in the Maldrelli Donovan household that have been told to us. I wonder why I'm a hypochondriac. But anyway, well, that definitely would have worked on me. I was and still am convinced that I will get every disease on the planet, including this new one that Rachel is going to tell us about later. But my sister is a very different person. She does not fear the arthritis like I do. And even if she did, the whole idea behind getting arthritis from a lifetime of cracking your knuckles is still pretty much folklore and completely unfounded, and so is stunting your growth from coffee consumption, in case you were wondering. So these are all the things that I learned about knuckle cracking in addition to the fact that I will be telling you about. Knuckle cracking is a very popular pastime. Studies estimate that anywhere between 25 and 54% of the U.S. population cracks their knuckles daily.
I believe it.
I do too. Yeah. I think it could be even more than 54%. I don't know who they were surveying. And as popular as the activity is, it's just as popular for researchers and like doctors to study the potential health effects of cracking your knuckles. If you put quote unquote knuckle cracking into PubMed, which is like the greatest search engine on the planet.
Claire would think so. It's where Claire can investigate, like put in any keyword and find 10 new diseases that you have.
Correct. Or put in my symptoms and like get to a diagnosis.
Is your browser homepage set to PubMed?
It is not. It will be soon. That's a great idea. So if you put knuckle cracking into PubMed, there are over 30 independent studies looking at what happens to your body when you crack your knuckles. Now, I know 30 doesn't sound like a lot, but there are a lot of diseases in the world. So to devote 30 to knuckle cracking, I think is a big deal. Not just looking at knuckle cracking, but also looking into like what goes into that signature pop. Mm. And so I'll describe that to you and then show how everything is related. So the popping is caused by this liquidy, slightly jelly-like stuff called synovial fluid, which lubricates and surrounds every joint. And when you forcefully bend your fingers in just the right way, this creates this bubble of air within the synovial fluid. And some people think that it's when the bubble bursts that results in this pop. But Rachel told me earlier before this episode or during it or, you know, whenever she has time to tell me things that apparently it's kind of controversial. And some people think it's actually when the bubble is being produced that creates this sound.
It's like when there's a vacuum forming and it's like
a vacuum forming.
Because it's like a question of like microseconds between whether it's the forming of the bubble or the bursting of the bubble.
Right. But the key is that this, you know, the popping happens. And the popping sound, I don't know about you all, but I think it's very addicting over the years. I was not as a child, but I too have become addicted to cracking my knuckles. And I just really love the sound of when it cracks. And I like how various knuckles have different sounds. I think about this too much, I think. Pravita's giving me this really weird look. She's like, who is this coworker, of mine?
Once you pop, you just can't stop.
Wait, so which is your favorite most?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. I really like, which I perfected in like college, these like little teeny ones. I don't think I could do it now.
Well, the ones where you have to kind of like press your fist to get them.
And you either do it, wait.
That was a good one.
And you either do them like really quickly at once, or some people like what Rachel was showing, that you do it like all at once and it goes click, 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 click. I'm like, I'm so jealous of you. But yeah, that is my favorite pop. Do you have a favorite knuckle cracking pop? You don't have to.
I honestly like to do my big toe, but I don't think that's
I can't. I have never been able to. Ooh.
Yeah, I have strange feet, but I don't think that's an auditory thing. It's more the feeling in my feet, like it tremors through my feet once I've done it.
Totally.
Yeah, it is very, like, it's satisfying, which is funny because it's, like, it's not, like, a very powerful sensation. It does seem like it kind of, like, because your body knows something is releasing, even though it's such a tiny, unimportant release, it's like, yeah. Like,
I can now move on with my life. Yeah. I so agree. But while the pop is super addicting to me, it's the pop that like freaks a lot of people out at the same time. In a lot of the studies of like people who are surveyed say like why they hate knuckle cracking so much is like the pop sounds so jarring. Like, one person or a couple of people compared it to scratching on, like, a chalkboard, which I, like, have never, like, scratching on a chalkboard is very painful to your ears. Cracking your knuckles is just a cool popping sound. I would never relate the two, but apparently a lot of people do. So, you know, people hear this popping sound, they're like, this sounds terrible, and so it must be terrible. And so I think, like, this is my opinion of how all of this started, with that it would cause arthritis, because it's just such a jarring sound that it must be, like, terrible for your body to create this sound. But if you look at all the observational studies, now these just look at, like, connections and seeing similarities between things. That's a really bad description of observational studies. I'm going to go with it, though. one of the largest to date, published in 1990 in the Annals of Rheumatic Diseases, it looked at 300 people, and 74 of them called themselves or identified as habitual knuckle crackers. The rates of arthritis between the 74 habitual knuckle crackers and the non-knuckle crackers was exactly the same. And multiple other studies similar to this one, observational ones, have found similar conclusions that there's no relationship to arthritis and cracking knuckles. Now, those are observational studies. So it's really hard to do a study that looks at people who, like, tell somebody to crack your knuckles and then tell other people not to crack your knuckles and then go live life.
Right.
Now, that brings me to Donald Unger. Now, Donald Unger, like my sister, like any normal kid, I think, loved to crack his knuckles, but his mom, too, hated it and scared him into thinking it would give him arthritis. So when he reached adulthood, he did the ultimate test and sacrifice. He studied himself, and he wrote about his findings in the Journal of Arthritis and Rheumatology in 1998, and I will just read his letter to you because it's quick, concise, and short and amazing. To the editor: does knuckle cracking lead to arthritis of the fingers? And he writes about himself in the third person, but this was really signed, Donald Unger. During the author's childhood, various renowned authorities, his mother, several aunts, and later his mother-in-law, informed him that cracking his knuckles would lead to arthritis of the fingers. To test the accuracy of this hypothesis, the following study was undertaken. For 50 years, the author cracked the knuckles of his left hand at least twice a day, leaving those on the right as a control. Thus, the knuckles on the left were cracked at least 36,500 times, while those on the right cracked rarely and spontaneously. At the end of the 50 years, the hands were compared for the presence of arthritis. There was no arthritis in either hand and no apparent differences between the two hands. Knuckle cracking did not lead to arthritis after a 50-year controlled study by the one participant. While a larger group, he admits, would be necessary to confirm this result, this preliminary investigation suggests the lack of correlation between knuckle cracking and the development of arthritis of the fingers. And then he adds all this great, like, lit review that he did. A search of the literature revealed only one previous paper on this subject, and the authors came to the same conclusion. This result calls into question whether other parental beliefs, e.g. the importance of eating spinach, are also flawed. Apparently he hates spinach. No. I love spinach. I don't know.
Yeah. Eat spinach, everyone.
Yeah. It's good.
Like, good sauteed, advice. You know? Yeah. Okay. Further investigation is likely warranted. In conclusion, there is no apparent relationship between knuckle cracking and the subsequent development of arthritis of the fingers. This study was done entirely on the author's expense, with no grants from any governmental or pharmaceutical source. Signed, Donald L. Unger, M.D., Thousand Oaks, California. So if that doesn't convince you, I don't know what will.
It's amazing.
Can you imagine the discipline of just cracking your knuckles on one hand and not the other for so many years?
I know. I feel like sometimes I think of myself as, like, a disciplined person. Like, I clean my bathroom once a week on Sunday nights and, like, random stuff like that. And I don't think I could do what Donald did.
A hero, truly. Sacrificed his life for science.
He did. He really did. So that's mainly what I have to say about knuckle cracking. I did find that, like, in all of my other research, I was trying to find other, like, tidbits to tell you all, but really found that there's no other serious injuries or long-term conditions that could result from knuckle cracking. The only thing that I found was in the American Journal of Orthopedics. I couldn't access the journal. Like, I just couldn't find the study. So all I had was this, like, four-sentence preview, and it just says, we present two cases in which acute injuries were suffered while the patients were attempting to crack their knuckles, but they don't say what they are, and I can't find it. So
Ooh, I can totally imagine someone like jamming or even breaking
yes,
a finger.
That's what I was looking for.
It would be like a fluke situation where just like their angle of attack mm-hmm. was
a knuckle cracking gone wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Now I really want to crack every single knuckle.
Yeah, including my big toe.
So let's take a quick break and then we'll be back after cracking everything. Okay, we're back. And I'm going to talk about muslin disease.
Great.
So this started because I was looking at a roundup of deadly fashions, because I love to read stuff like that, just like fashion trends that were bad for your body. There's all different examples all over the world. You've got corsets, you've got foot binding, you've got muslin dresses, perhaps. So according to this listicle I read, thin muslin dresses that were popular after the French Revolution may have contributed to a health epidemic. And I decided I must know more. So after the French Revolution, things got very weird in a lot of ways. There were a lot of rules for a while about limiting excess. But then the rich people came back into power and there just wasn't the monarch anymore. It was just, you know, rich people. So things just got like bizarre. Like people were almost more over the top with their displays of wealth than they had been before the French Revolution mm-hmm. and in just like doing weird new things with it. One example is that there were these balls that were only open to the grown children of people who'd been guillotined. And they would wear mourning clothes and would allegedly greet each other by like rolling their heads really violently.
No.
That part might not be true, but there were definitely balls for relatives of guillotined people where they all like dressed in black and were like, let's party. And so there were also some like weird fashion trends that were almost like Dadaist in their level of like absurdity with fashion. Like, for example, if you've ever seen the movie A Clockwork Orange and they're wearing little like bowler hats. I don't even know if that's kind of hat there, but little hats like monocles and like walking around with canes. That's like very much reminiscent of fashion trends that actually existed among like well-to-do young French men in these years after the French Revolution when wealth became okay to display again, but people like didn't know how to do it without being weird. And so through some combination of like the glorification of aristocratic women like sitting in plain white shifts waiting to be guillotined, and then the simplification of fashion for years due to laws immediately following the war, and just like the absurd subcultures of grieving and traumatized young people among the rich, it became very popular to wear these extremely thin dresses regardless of the weather. Marie Antoinette, you know, not long before her death, had started wearing these like very like plain white dresses when she was on like her little fake farm. If you've seen the movie about Marie Antoinette, mm-hmm. she had a little fake farm where she liked to like the eggs were all pre-cleaned and she'd be like, look, an egg right from a chicken.
But she'd still wear her wigs with these.
Yes, but they were like down. Chill wigs. they were really like flowy wigs. So yeah, this is all to say that in kind of like 19th century France, and even elsewhere in Europe, a lot of women were wearing extremely thin dresses, mm-hmm. which was so different from what had been the fashion before the French Revolution. You know, they had so many layers and corsets and framework.
Petticoats.
Yes. Like just like wire frames of all sorts under your hair, under your skirts. Exactly. Some people still say today, but definitely some people said at the time that women would dampen the cloth of their very simple white dresses to make it even clingier. So it was like the skinny jeans of the 19th century. And contemporary scholars actually blamed flu and consumption outbreaks on women catching a chill because they were wearing these thin and or damp dresses.
Even though that's yes. proven
yes.
to not cause a cold.
That is my next note. I said Claire is going to say that being cold doesn't give you a cold, and that is true. Though if you're really cold when you have like advanced tuberculosis, yes, that's probably not like
not
great
beneficial.
For you. You should like wear a sweater. But there's no evidence at all that women typically dampen the cloth. It's probably something that like occasionally maybe courtesans would do in a very like performative way, like wet t-shirt contest style, or it was related to like satirical cartoons. They loved satirical cartoons at this time, and there are a bunch of them of women in dresses where like the dresses are literally like up their butts so that you can see, you know, the whole butt. and men loved making fun of how see-through these dresses were. So it's possible that jokes about how women looked like they were wearing, like, clingy wet garments turned into people just saying, like, yeah, it's a thing all the young women are doing, and we're really bad historically at picking out satire, especially when it comes to the behavior of young women. So what became more intriguing to me in looking at this was the link between these wispy fashions and shivering young women and the beauty standards of the day, which glorified death. So I was reading this book that was originally published in 1901 about tuberculosis because there was, you know, when I said that doctors would sometimes blame these wispy dresses that may or may not have been dampened for effect for contributing to outbreaks of what they called muslin disease, that was tuberculosis, which at the time was frequently called consumption, but it was before anyone had isolated the bacterium that actually causes TB. So they really didn't actually know how it was transmitted, but it was reaching like epidemic levels. So it was something that people thought about and talked about a lot, even though they didn't really understand it. So I was reading this book originally from 1901 about TB, and I came across a passage about Edgar Allan Poe's two consumptive brides, the first being his child bride, Virginia. And apparently at a party in 1842, she was dressed in white and, quote, delicately, morbidly angelic. And then she was like playing music and she had a hemorrhage in her lungs and coughed up, quote, a wave of blood all over her dress. And he found this, like, charming. He was like, my beautiful, delicate bride. I think she was also, like, 14 at the time. So, yikes. But we now know that tuberculosis is from a contagious bacterium. It existed for thousands of years, infected humans for thousands of years based on archaeological evidence. But it reached epidemic levels due to, like, crowded living and lack of sanitation in cities. But it is really easily transmitted once you have it through coughing and spit. So it very quickly transcended class. So the reason it became so much more common was people being crowded into these really, like, unhygienic cities and slums. But then once it existed in a city, like, anybody could get it.
It was anyone's game.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So that's how tuberculosis then came to be considered an actually, like, upper-class disease. Because if you just, like, got sick and died and you were poor, like, they were like, ew, gross, you know, whatever.
Bye.
And it also probably, like, killed you much quicker because you were working and, you know, didn't have access to as much food and warmth, et cetera. But some doctors actually thought that beauty was, like, a sign you were more susceptible to TB because they would talk about how girls who grew up being, like, thin with pale skin and, like, red lips and bright eyes, that they seemed to get TB more than other girls. But it was because, like, those were usually a sign of the low-grade fevers you might have for years before you started having really dangerous TB symptoms. Ooh. So you would just be kind of, like, wasting away and have, like, a low-grade fever and, like, cough occasionally. And they were like, yeah, all these hot girls keep getting TB. all the hot girls with rosy cheeks who just, like, cough prettily. So they thought it was probably something, first of all, that ran in families. But also there was this idea that it was actually, like, the overexcitement of a passionate constitution would cause the disease. So for a while it was male poets who were really into this idea. Lord Byron, who was featured on the show several times, he was on maybe the first episode?
Yeah.
Yeah, Claire was talking about how he was the first celebrity diet. He ate potatoes and crackers and vinegar.
And that was it.
He really wanted to be pale and thin and beautiful. Mm-hmm. He was also recently on an episode where he talked about Mary Shelley, because Lord Byron was a real dog, did a lot of women wrong. He apparently said, how pale I look. I should like, I think, to die of consumption, because then the women would all say, see that poor Byron? How interesting he looks in dying.
Oh my God, that is such a Lord Byron quote.
He just wanted to eat potatoes and vinegar until he was nothing. So, yeah, there was this sense that it was like, because, again, you had these bright eyes from the fever and really pale skin, but then, like, rosy cheeks, mm-hmm. and you were kind of, like, languid. So it all lent itself to this idea that you were just, like, you were like full of fire, but it was so much that it like weakened you.
See, that's a bad observational study.
That was the fire. That was the fever that was, you know, making you full of fire and then weakening you. So yeah, into like the mid-1800s, you saw the rise of what some researchers, a lot of this comes from a book by Carolyn A. Day called Consumptive Chic. They called it Consumptive Chic. And you had like tiny waists, often involving corsets. And also corsets were great for consumptive chic because it would also make your collarbones stand out more. And so, like, as much of your bones could stand out as possible, great. Tiny waist, pale skin, which they often, you know, used, like, arsenic to get. So that was not great. Big, bright eyes, which they often used belladonna drops to get. Poisonous, don't do that. You have this general sense that beautiful young women from, like, good families are actually, like, more likely to get TB because it's this, like, you're just kind of, like, overcome by your gentle nature and like the passions of the world have just like overwhelmed you.
Wow, I really hate this.
Yeah, same. Then there was like, I read one thing that was like in the 1850s, a few physicians even thought that the spitting of blood that would happen when you were, you know, having like hemorrhages in your lungs was evidence of a displaced form of menstruation.
Oh my God, no.
it's all just one, it's the body's just one thing.
Guys,
you know?
Are just terrified of menstruation.
I think men still believe this, probably.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely true. So yeah, it really transferred from that time when Lord Byron was like, we should all be so lucky as to be skinny and sad and lethargic, to being like really a disease of wealthy women and something to be emulated. Once we understood it more, which happened when...
Wait, did you say emulated? Like people wanted...
Right. So people would use arsenic to give themselves fuller skin.
Right.
And
mm-hmm,
then... Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was very much like... tuberculosis already kind of made people fit the beauty ideals that existed. Mm-hmm. But then as more and more people got tuberculosis and they were really glorified, like a lot of the pre-Raphaelite models had consumption. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A lot of famous courtesans were painted, you know, looking pale and like kind of glistening, and then they died of consumption. So that just kind of was like a feedback loop where then people were like, oh yeah, even more of this like pale and sweaty look, please.
Really all they needed was like a Sephora and a Pilates machine.
Yeah, absolutely. And so once we understood it more, it was 1882 when the microbe was identified. Then, like, once people knew that it was spread by bacteria, it really lost its aristocratic edge. And so then they were like, ew, gross. Consumption is from germs. So it's only for poor people. So actually then fashion shifted to highlight curves because they were like, you don't want to die of consumption. Maybe you should eat a little bit more so you don't just like pass out and die. Dresses were starting to be made shorter so that you wouldn't drag germs inside from the filthy streets, which probably didn't do much. But
I feel like that was like, that's kind of smart.
Yeah, right. It was like, it's worth a try,
yeah,
you know.
Totally.
It definitely would have made like houses cleaner, if not less full of TB germs. And then like, you know, doctors started to tell people to go to like warm climates as therapy for TB. Mm-hmm. And so then like sun exposure and light exercise became more popular. So like it started to become trendy to look healthy and radiant and not glowing in a way that looks like maybe you're about to pass out and die.
Wow, what a concept.
Yeah, I know. It's
healthy
crazy.
Healthy is cool.
And it's just so interesting because it really does come down to this obsession with women who are close to or actually dead. And it was like a very pervasive thing leading up to and during the Victorian era. And it's really, it's like pretty simple when you think about it. A woman who is near death is as passive and delicate as a woman can be. There's a lot of poetry and art around this concept, but this one that I came across that I felt like just really said it all was this poem by William Butler Yeats called "He Wishes His Beloved Were Dead."
Oh, my God.
So I don't have the whole poem here, but some select quotes. "He claims that if his beloved were lying cold and dead, he would lay his hand on her breast, and she would murmur tender words to him, and that she wouldn't hasten away even though she has the will of wild birds." So it's like you can finally control this, like, wild, passionate woman because she's dead.
But she was wild and passionate. So he gets to, like, have his cake and eat it
too. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, just really fascinating glimpse into a topic that will probably inspire several more episodes of Weirdest Thing. Because once you talk about, like, why people romanticize corpses so much to the extent that they influenced decades of fashion, you know, there's a lot there. And it's still a thing today, obviously. You know, there are periodically, there will be some, like, high fashion editorial shoot that features like a tableau that's clearly the lead up to or aftermath of violence against women. You know, there's like a beautiful high fashion model like laying at the bottom of a set of stairs or having people like menacingly walk up to her. And we still obviously as a culture are pretty obsessed with the idea of women being imperiled and threatened. But at least now I don't think most mainstream culture is obsessed with women literally laying there about to die, slowly, of consumption. As Edgar Allan Poe said of his second wife with consumption, she had a cough that was killing her by inches, and there were almost no inches left. And that was really the most you could hope for, just to be 1 inch of a woman and hold on as long as possible in that state.
Murmuring.
So that's it. That's what I got.
That's great.
I would wonder,
a lot,
like,
to think about.
What would be the fashion trend from rich people today that would, I guess it would differ by country, but that would really have that kind of top-down effect on society?
Yeah.
I can't think of any.
That's right. I'm like, what would it be?
I don't know. Fashion so like stale. Gluten-free or something.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, there are like a lot of like lifestyle trends that like have wellness. That kind of effect. I mean, I guess like you have high heels and skinny jeans and other things where it's like it just becomes the norm that this very uncomfortable thing is what's popular. Yeah, and so then that affects like the way we move and the way we want other clothes to fit and the kinds of activities we want to participate in. But yeah, I don't know. Certainly nothing to this extent. Luckily, we are no longer such a slave to fashion, but still, we probably still have a long way to go. Yeah.
I did get an email from Levi's about their latest high-waisted jeans, which are called ribcage jeans.
Ouch. Just that's like not high-waisted.
How high
above
can you
your
go?
Waist?
How much higher can they go?
Well, right, because like originally high-waisted jeans were us like rebelling against low-cut jeans that are like, you know, at least for most bodies past pubescence, like just like not going to be flattering, not going to be comfortable. They cut you right where you don't want jeans to cut into when you sit. And, you know, for a while, high-waisted jeans, it was like, I remember a bunch of like hot takes from dudes being like, girls, your high-waisted jeans look dumb. And I was like, I don't care. Also, they don't. They look great. But now it's like if the high-waisted jeans literally go up like to your underboob, then that's just a corset. I tried like an Instagram ad shaper for like, you know, wearing under like formal wear. And it was very much like, you know, Spanx, like they just squeeze you all like uniformly and it's really not meant for like highlighting curves, which is totally true. They just kind of like squish your thigh into your butt. And this was like, you know, this is cut and designed so that it actually like only cinches you in where you want it to. And it works really well, but I put it on. I was like, this is a girdle. This is just literally a girdle. And yes, it works very well. But like, there's a reason why girdles became unpopular. It's because they're f***ing uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I guess we haven't gotten to a point where we can have something as relatively comfortable as a pair of Spanx that is as effective as a girdle. Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess that's the white whale. So
totally.
We'll watch this space. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with one more fact. Okay, we're back. And Pramita, it is time for your first Weirdest Thing fact.
Well, mine goes back a few months ago to when I went to see a stand-up show by Hannah Gadsby of Nanette fame, if anyone has seen that Netflix
yes,
special.
Excellent.
So Hannah Gadsby is from Australia. She was touring the U.S. for her newest stand-up routine, which is fantastic, and I think will also be streamed pretty soon. So the name of the show was called Douglas, which was named after her dog. makes sense. But then she goes down this rabbit hole of talking about historic gynecology. And it stems from Douglas. She wanted to talk about this very little known part of the female anatomy, which is called the pouch of Douglas. And it kind of floats in your body between... Claire or Rachel, do either of you know about this?
I was just like, okay, playing it in my head. I'm
fascinated.
Like, I don't know.
So if you're listening from home and also didn't know, don't feel bad. It's this tiny little space that floats between your rectum and your vagina. And Hannah Gadsby basically described it as, you know, when you have a piece of luggage or a suitcase and there's that one zipper that you always unzip and it doesn't actually open the suitcase. It just like makes it a little bit taller.
I know exactly what zipper that is.
That was her analogy, which is perfect. But medically, it's called the rectouterine pouch. Very sexy. It's also called the pouch of Douglas, which I'll get into, or a cul-de-sac.
just a nice suburban.
Yeah, very, very suburban. You could see like your family practitioner maybe using that analogy on you or something. So the reason why it's named after a man, even though it only exists in female bodies, is it goes back to Mary Toft, which I know is one of Rachel's icons. She actually dressed up as her for Halloween this year.
Yes, at the live show.
So this is back in 1700s England, and James Douglas, he was a Scottish physician and a midwife, which there were a lot of male midwives at this time, so that was becoming quite the trend. And that has its own fascinating story because part of it is that forceps came into play in birthing techniques, and only male physicians were using these forceps and kind of took over the midwife space to deliver babies. So anyway, James Douglas was one of these midwives. Some documents call him a feminist midwife because he opened a clinic where underprivileged women could actually have a safe space to give birth. Mm-hmm. Sounds great. He also did public dissections of dead female cadavers where he would invite people, mostly rich people, to come to his house and watch him look at different parts.
Yeah, not great.
Gross.
Yeah.
Yeah, of female parts. So fun stuff. He was also a physician extraordinary to Queen Caroline. I don't know what that title means, but it sounds wonderful, I guess. So the Mary Toft connection, basically Mary Toft, have you talked about her on the show before?
Yeah, we had an episode about her. I'm just the briefest version is that she pretended she was giving birth to rabbits repeatedly by shoving chunks of dead rabbit and other animals into her softened cervix. And she fooled many doctors for quite a time, but then was eventually found out because they isolated her and people were found trying to sneak her rabbits. So she can.
So like Donald Unger, the knuckle cracker, a true dedicated individual to swaying scientific opinion. So James Douglas was one of the skeptics when it came to Mary Toft. And eventually it did come out that this was a giant hoax and she went to prison for it. And this only grew James Douglas's career because he was one of the smart, quote unquote, few who was like, this is physically impossible. So during these many public dissections, James Douglas, you know, he got more into kind of mapping the uterine area in women. And one of the spots he found is this pouch of Douglas. So essentially, there's no real way to describe it. It's like this region of negative space where it just allows your organs. It's not an organ itself because it doesn't really have a specific function, but it allows your other organs to kind of slide by and expand. It's just there to like hold everything else and
cushion.
Yeah, it's like that. I don't want to say a friend with benefits, but like that one friend who you just like keep on going back to when you just need like a shoulder.
Yeah, totally.
That's
like
the
back burner.
Yeah, exactly.
Back burner friend.
I've seen in some medical journals as it being described as an infinitesimal space, which I feel is hyperbolic because we are not infinitesimal on our insides, no matter what you think about women. But, Yeah, so it provides a lot of cushion. It kind of supports your bladder, you know, when when you're really, you know, trying to go for days without peeing, I guess.
Don't recommend that.
Yeah. So there isn't a ton of medical research on it just because it seems like doctors don't quite know what to do with the pouch of Douglas. But in recent times, there have been more gynecologists and surgeons looking into this space because it seems to be a good indicator of really serious gynecological or reproductive issues. For example, like they can check it for lesions that can affect other parts of the uterine area. It can be the way that your parts like slide against it. I don't know exactly the mechanism, but by looking at that motion within the pouch of Douglas, doctors might be able to detect if you'll get endometriosis later in life. And endometriosis is, you know, an extremely painful condition that affects a ton of women, where just like when you're having your period and your uterine lining sheds every month, instead your uterine lining grows on like other parts like your intestines and other tubes. It also tries to shed but has nowhere to go. So then you just have a ton of dead tissue up in there, and that buildup is, you know, painful, deadly, whatnot. So there needs to be like a lot more investigation into this, but it's possible that the pouch of Douglas can help with some preventative measures. Also with ectopic pregnancies, sometimes there are like some really terrible side effects that can also show up in this space. So it's still a mystery. But I just love this idea that we have this little pouch inside ourselves. And, you know, it's maybe we're all marsupials, but we just don't show it on the outside.
Yeah.
I don't know. How does it feel to know that you just have this new part?
It's really fascinating that it is like defined by its negative space. That's super interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if it will actually, like, if it does. Well, I guess it doesn't have any functions, so I guess it can never be an organ eventually. But I think it's always cool when you hear about, like, new organ. I'm like, oh, man.
Yeah, especially because our bodies seem to be to have evolved to be so efficient. Like, everything is packed in there, and everything has to have a use.
Has to have a reason, or a use
but
for it.
But maybe not.
I bet there's more uses for the pouch of Douglas.
Yeah.
Because, like, why else would it be there, right?
Yeah.
So what was that other, like, organ recently? It was like the mesentery or something.
Oh,
I forget what it was.
Something
but
in
it was
the GI
like,
system.
Yeah, that like sits on the outside of your intestines and like holds your intestines in.
Like a nice hug.
Like a nice hug. Like an actual suitcase for your intestines.
Well, and there's like, you know, for years everyone was like, oh, the appendix is a vestigial organ. Like, it doesn't do anything. And now there's a bunch of research on, like, well, maybe actually there's, like, some important microbiome stuff going on in there, which sucks because mine is gone.
Oh, really?
And I mean, it's good that it's gone because I had appendicitis, so it would have sucked to keep it in there. But at the time, everyone was like, don't even worry. It doesn't even do a darn thing.
And like, you're like, better off without it.
Yeah. Well, and actually, now there's a lot more research into how often you can avoid appendectomies by just using antibiotics. And so I'm like, what if like 10 years from now, everyone's like, yeah, can you believe we used to just like lop those off whenever they were infected?
Right.
So
much we still don't know about the human body.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So shout out to Hannah Gadsby for teaching me something that my gynecologist never taught me. I'm definitely going to fire her. But.
I love it. I would do the same.
So what was the weirdest thing we learned this week?
This is hard. They're all such good ones.
It was a good week.
Yeah. I mean, I love learning about a new disease and a new organ, but I don't think I have tuberculosis, luckily. So
I'm really glad. Once I said that, I was like, because I knew that you wouldn't think you had muslin disease.
Right.
Because you're not walking around in, like, wet dresses.
Yeah.
But then I was like, oh, no, but what if she thinks she has tuberculosis?
No, I think,
so I'm glad you don't.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'm confident.
I think it may be a tie week. I think we learned three really interesting things about bodies.
Yeah.
Dead body is live body is.
Right. I was going to say, I was like, I don't think I have TB. So maybe I think that this new organ I might have is also cool. Or not organ, but, you know, dead space.
Dead space. Infinitesimal space. Infinitesimal space. I really, I mean, the knuckles is just so relatable, obviously. And to think that we do these things without actually knowing how they affect us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So that's amazing.
True.
But, you know, that muslin yarn that you spun was just...
yeah.
It went in so many directions I did not expect.
Just a nice Victorian necrophilia tale.
Yeah, and you got in your Lord Byron references, which
it's
I'm quickly learning.
It was truly an all-in.
That was like the last thing I found, and I was like, yes!
I love it.
Great. Well, a great week for all of us here on Weirdest Thing. The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week is a popular science podcast. We're available on all major podcast platforms, so subscribe wherever you're listening now. And if you like what you hear, please rate and review us on iTunes. It helps other weirdos find the show. You can buy our merch, including Weirdest Thing t-shirts, tote bags, and mugs at popside.threadless.com. Our show is produced by all of our hosts, including me, Rachel Feltman, and our editors, Jess Bodie and Jason Letterman. Our theme music is by Billy Cadden. If you have questions, suggestions, or weird stories to share, tweet us at weirdest_thing. Thanks for listening, weirdos.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.